We're coming to the 16th presentation on hermetic bodhisattvas. And one of the primordial occurrences for our kind is to have stories told to us. All human children love to have things read to them all over the world in all languages. There is something even more basic than fundamental for our kind to hear. So that all of the sutras of the historical Buddha begin, "Thus have I heard." One of the most memorable refrains of Jesus is, "Those who have ears to hear, let them hear." In Indian thought and civilization, the most primordial occurrence in the universe is that a sound, in Sanskrit called svota, makes it possible for hearing to occur, even in the dark before there is light. There was a great svota temple at the beginnings of the Khyber Pass, going from what is today northern Pakistan into what is today Afghanistan. And that svota temple now has been ruins for 1,000 years, 1,500 years, but it's still left standing as ruins. The ability to hear is more refined in us than the ability to see. Especially if there is a modulation so that we get into the rhythm. Because the rhythm in sound is the dimension of time. And one of the most poignant occurrences in music, rhythm, timing is a silence. When asked one time, Mozart was talking about the composition, his way of creating his music, some 600 plus compositions. He said the most important element in composition and music is the judicious use of silence. One of the greatest musical works of the 20th century was Ralph Vaughan Williams' Ninth Symphony, which was first performed just 7 hours before he died at 86. And the elan of the fourth movement comes to an almost Beethoven amplitude of crescendo, which has a pointed pause, resumes again and builds and a silence. And by the time it's starting to build, you can hear that it is losing energy. And then there is a third silence. And you begin to understand that this was his final expression of his ability to compose music. It is an aspect that is featured in many of the great hermetic teachers. The hermetic silence is always given illustration of the finger to the lips. With Mercury, Hermes, with his winged hat and his cape and his ability to have the caduceus but also his ability to have a silence, which is the way to reach us at our deepest possible being. That if we can be prepared by language, by the time, rhythm, cadence of good language in a poetic, and we can come to the moment before time has one more beat, so that at that particular unique moment, there is an opportunity to transcend even time. In the writings of Virginia Woolf, she calls that an eternal moment. And in her composition of her great novels, if they are read out loud, there are those peculiar eternal moments of pausing. And it is a yogic technique that one can come to the threshold of primordiality and cross it. And what one crosses over, the Buddha would call that the other shore. We have been presenting women as, for the past couple of weeks, as hermetic bodhisattvas of the 20th century, and we're going to bring another into play today. Her name is Hannah Arendt, and she is one of the greatest hermetic bodhisattvas of the 20th century. And she was, as the other female hermetic bodhisattvas, she was associated with extraordinary men. The first one that we talked about was Vimalasankara. And she was, even as a little girl, already into her ability to go into those eternal moments, and apprenticed herself very young to Mahatma Gandhi. And then after he was assassinated with his successor, Vinoba Bhave. And then she was in Holland, and she listened to a presentation, a lecture by Krishnamurti, and for the rest of her life, she was with Krishnamurti. And one of her beautiful little books, she liked writing little books, From Intellect to Intelligence, has this on the back. Man has studied his biological structure, but not enough of his psychology. Occidental experts have divided the psyche into the conscious, the unconscious, and the subconscious. But there is a fourth dimension of non-cerebral energy, which is accepted now by psychologists. To arrive at the fourth dimension, silence is the gateway and the only way. And her next little book was Silence in Action. We then, last week, moved to psychology, to Marie-Louise von Franz, who from age 18 was apprenticed to Carl Jung. She had visited Zurich from her home city of Munich, and Jung found that she was extraordinary. And as she lived, she grew and grew, but Jung said to her, "You need to live with a close psychological proximity to a very talented older woman who's old enough to be your grandmother, Barbara Hannah." And the two of them shared a house in Zurich for the rest of Barbara's life. We're looking at today Hannah Arendt, who as a very brilliant young woman was the student of one of the most powerful philosophers of the 20th century, Martin Heidegger. But she also became friends with the only philosopher who probably would have been able to save her from Heidegger's brilliance. And I say save her because when the Nazis took over Germany, Heidegger became the philosophic spokesman for the Nazis. And Hannah Arendt was Jewish. She was very close to another Jewish woman who happened to be the wife of another brilliant psychologist, philosopher, Karl Jaspers. And I have passed out some materials, a couple of pages. I have put the portraits of Hannah Arendt when she was young and when she was mature. Next week, I will bring some photos of her in New York when she was old and very, very outspokenly distinguished. Karl Jaspers, when he was young, was a psychologist. And in fact, he wrote the first European book on psychotherapy as a textbook. And when he was in his middle life, he was enormously distinguished. When the Nazis took over, they forbade him to lecture publicly at any university. They put him under house arrest. They would not kill him because of his distinguished capacity, but because he had a Jewish wife, they were not allowed to leave the house for 12 years. The ability to withstand and endure led to him having correspondence with a number of people, and his correspondence with Hannah Arendt is 850 pages. She purposely kept tie lines of the openness of wisdom in one of the darkest eras of world history from 1933 to 1945 is the time that Tolkien wrote Lord of the Rings. So you can understand that there are aspects to hermetic bodhisattvas where they are able to endure and even prevail over conditions that are, for all psychological intents and purposes, for all philosophical considerations, hopeless, that there is no way out whatsoever. But the hermetic bodhisattvas do not work on cognition. And their recognition is a preparation for crossing that threshold of silence and being operative then, because they are free to be, to come and go, where that threshold of silence is for them a refreshing, like a refreshing wave, and they can come and go, and they have the ability to share that with all sentient beings, not just men and women, but animals, plants, all sentient beings. And their function is to keep those thresholds into infinity open, so that their qualities are extraordinary and are shareable. And the sharing comes initially through hearing. Because one can be nightmare frozen by fear, by uncanny fear. And the psychophysical sense is that you are going to be swallowed up. But there is a curious trans-psychological state that occurs when you completely fill up with nightmare fear, with phobic frightenedness. You literally will have your hair stand on end, and the sense of your eternity will float above your psychophysical being like a Holy Spirit dove. That quality is communicable by sharing, in the sense that the Hermetic tradition and the Bodhisattva tradition, and as we'll see, that there is a third version from the ancient Celtic, from the shores around the Irish Sea, of the Celtic mysteries, that the portal for that was locked up, was knotted up into the mystery of the Holy Grail. And we'll take a look at that in a couple of weeks to come. What is interesting to us is that one of the original sharings of that capacity to enter into infinity across the threshold that becomes not only a two-way access, but becomes kaleidoscopic in time. But the original registering of sharing, the best word to use for it is the ancient Celtic word that translates as mystery, is mystery. One of the most powerful ways to state this came in the Gospel according to Thomas, the sayings of the living Jesus, written down by Thomas Didymus. And here at the very end, because Peter was misogynist, his wife died very young, and he was embittered. And his wife's mother ran his house, which was quite sizable. It was near the shore of the Sea of Galilee, and the Capernaum synagogue was literally in his backyard. And they're still there today. The synagogue is refurbished. There's a little parkland, then there's the house of Peter. The mother of his wife was the wife of a man named Aristobulus. And Aristobulus was one of three brothers. One of his other brothers was the oldest, and his name was Alphaeus. And Alphaeus had two sons. One of them was the man who became the apostle Matthew. His given name was Levi, but Jesus called him Gift of God, Matthew. And his brother was named James, but because there was another James who was really something, he was always referred to as James the Less or James the Minor. And the other James was the oldest son of the third brother, who was the youngest, and his name was Zebedee, went from A to Z through Aristobulus. And his two sons were James and John, St. James and St. John. So that St. James and St. John and St. Matthew and James the Less were cousins. Do you understand? They were not only cousins, they were nephews of Jesus. Because the wife of Zebedee was Jesus' older sister, Salome. And he had four sisters. And one of the sisters was named Mary. And she had a son. He was the youngest of them all. And his name was Mark. He became Saint Mark. So that when you look at Matthew, Mark, and John, and James, they're all nephews of Jesus. They're all cousins of each other. And 500 years later, all of the members of Arthur's Round Table were related through five centuries of inheritance. And they were all either cousins or nephews. And the greatest of them was not Lancelot, who was from the French side of the family, but was Sir Gawain, who was a direct nephew of King Arthur. So that the Celtic mystery tradition, when we come to it, is not so much a hermetic guide, not so much a bodhisattva helper, but is a defender, is a chivalric knight. So that the code of knightly chivalry is a part of the hermetic bodhisattva, but is a mystery part of it and needs to be considered a little bit differently. By the way, because no one had ever done a good portrait of St. Matthew, I took from the Great Chalice of Antioch the old St. Matthew and use a spirit vision to bring this portrait of what he looked like in the time of Jesus. He was formidable and very trustworthy. There are portraits also on that particular document, that chalice, which is in fact the Holy Grail, and which, just like, oddly enough, maybe synchronistically, like the ending of Spielberg's great Indiana Jones and the Raiders of the Lost Ark, where it ends up in a warehouse, the actual Holy Grail has ended up in a museum warehouse in New York City. If you go up the coast of the Hudson River, just past Columbia University, and you get to the Cloisters, which is a huge medieval museum complex, there you will find in its storerooms the Holy Grail. And on it are portraits. This is the portrait of St. John as a young man. This is the portrait, this is St. James, this is St. John. These two portraits, now James was beheaded in 44 AD. So this was painted, this was drawn from someone who drew him originally before 44 AD. This of St. John, when he was younger, John was about 10 years younger than James. And John lived to over 77 years. And he died, he went into his comesis in about 101 AD. The interesting thing is that that chalice also has a portrait of the very young Jesus. This is Jesus at age 23, which was done in 14 AD. So whoever did these portraits knew Jesus for a long time and exceedingly well. And here's a portrait of Jesus at the maturity. So the person who did these portraits was an extremely accomplished artist. And in fact, the two big elephant folio volumes on the Great Chalice of Antioch, which I'll bring in a set in a couple of weeks, an original set published in 1923, limited edition. These portraits are from a classic Greek artist who was a sculptor, and his name was Scopas. And Scopas was one of the really great portrait artists of around the time of Plato. And his technique was to focus on the esoteric spiral of energy that rendered the features of someone into the spirit person, and that the entry point for that would be one of the eyes, and that the rest of the composition of the features of the face would be this almost invisible energy spiral that, as you would get to know the person through the portrait, you would begin to get the presence of that person in your person. This later on, when it was codified in Byzantine times, became the Byzantine theory of the icon. But 1,000 years before there were Byzantine icons, there were real portraits of actual people that were able to, through the art, prismatically convey the presence of the person. Here at the close of the Gospel of Thomas, Peter, misogynist. Simon Peter said to them, "Let Mary go out from among us," Mary Magdalene, "because women are not worthy of the life." Jesus said, "See, I shall lead her so that I will make her male, that she too may become a living spirit resembling you males. For every woman who makes herself male will enter the kingdom of heaven." Not male as a gender, but as the species of man, that beyond gender, which is a pairing, in a universe of paired life, there is not a unity of a neuter where male and female cross each other out and you have a neuter. That's the regression. The demonic is always neuter. Doesn't care about men or women whatsoever. Masculinity or femininity wants to neuter it. Beyond that is the kaleidoscopic, where a living being is kaleidoscopically real and can come ambidextrous, male, female. And in that ambidextrousness, there are sharings of love, which can be personal, but can now extend and extend and extend resonantly, so that there is such a thing as being the friend, lover of all sentient life. That's a bodhisattva. That's a hermetic guider. And in the first of the Hermetic treatises, the Poemandres, the creative poetry, poiesis, Poemandres, the creative mind shepherd, when Hermes Trismegistus, who has spirit adopted Tot as his son, has this beautiful dialogue with him, which is the treatise, and matures him to the point to where Hermes Trismegistus says to Tot, "And now, my son, we must remain silent for a moment, because our language has begun to flow together in such a way that is no longer a dialogue, but is a cascade of truth. And in that waterfall of truth, we must simply behold it in silence." This quality is interesting because in the Odes of Solomon, written because she understood Peter very well, she understood all of them very well, including Jesus, it reads like this. This is James Charlesworth's fine translation. "I was rescued from my chains, and I fled unto thee, O my God, because thou art the right hand of salvation and my helper. Thou hast restrained those who rise up against me, and no more were they seen. Because thy face was with me, which saved me by thy grace. But I was despised and rejected in the eyes of many, and I was in their eyes like lead. And I acquired strength from thee and help. A lamp thou didst set for me, both on my right and my left, so that there might not be in me anything that is not light. And I was covered with the covering of thy spirit. And I removed from me my garments of skin, because thy right hand exalted me and caused sickness to pass from me, and I became mighty in thy truth and holy in thy righteousness. And all my adversaries were afraid of me. And I became the Lord's by the name of the Lord. And I was justified by his kindness, and his rest is forever and ever. Hallelujah." So this quality of the Hermetica, of the Gospels, of the way which was never called Christianity, but was always simply called the way of the Lord. And the earliest, 2,000 years before, the name that was called upon as the Lord in that sense was Ahura. And Ahura had the ability in Zarathustra's Gathas, 4,000 years ago, 2,000 years before the 0 BC, 1 AD threshold, Ahura had the ability to have a Shraosha spirit in the way in which poetic language was shareable, to let those who were sharing it come through him as a portal into the radiance of Mazda. And that Mazda then was that transcendent spirit. And thus, Ahura was not important as the Lord so much as the Lord was gifting the Shraosha spirit of shareability so that anyone who could appreciate the mantra, the poetic language form, would be able to hear in between the lines, beyond the verses into the infinite radiance of a Mazda, and later on in more ungenious times, Ahura was put together with Mazda. And when that was done, it obviated the ability to understand the primordiality transcendence of Zarathustra, and one has now the same thing to do with the Odes of Solomon, to understand that they are by Mary Magdalene, and that the pivot in between them is the Song of Songs in the Old Testament, written by the Queen of Sheba, who takes some of Solomon's own poetic and weaves it with hers so that you begin to get this shareable fabric that the two of them were not only fertile together, they had a son, but they also left a gorgeous poetic in the Old Testament, which is that of the transcendent radiance of love that is shareable. Because for Solomon, when he was younger, before he met Makeda, the Queen of the South, as Jesus called her, he was always respecting the feminine wisdom spirit, the chokmah, the ability to be living with her, because living as her tone being with him, largely through his mother, initially Bathsheba, but hearkening all the way back to Sargon of Akkad, who, when he wrote of himself, said, "As a young man, I learned to love wisdom, and I lived with her in such a way that as Inanna, she blessed me of being able to be king of kings for 55 years. We're going to take a break, and then we'll come back. Let's come back to, these are my translations of Zarathustra from 4,000 years ago. In this particular Yasna 32, Zarathustra then is talking about the inverse corruptibility that haunts the world at that time. Their powers greedily take over the worst place in our mind. Life destroyed by possessiveness. Their Mazda yearns to complain. Your mantra messenger guards against such threats towards Asha. These greedy, captive-holding Kavis, whom Herod is not held to, they say power is long custom. Thus prepared, deceit is helped, and death brought to life. But the deathless one kindles help. Thereby is deterioration by both Karpans and Kavis, with their hands so locked, never let life flow freely. These two kinds take away good from our mind presence. So wisdom always needs to be strong. And especially at times where there is being posited, planted a new carrier wave. The time forms of civilization, as we've been talking about, have millennial metronomes that when the millennia pair, after two millennia, there is a registry of a new carrier wave. If you picture a horizon, this horizon is the zero field of nature. Time is the primordial energy that starts the universe. And one can see that its energy frequency, sine wave, starts from the zero horizon and makes its trough in about 500 years, and then rises back, crossing the zero field horizon at the first millennia, and then crests, equals the trough, so that the energy has synergy and symmetry, and then curves back down to cross again the zero horizon field of nature, and that is the new carrier wave. The millennium is a pivot between the old carrier wave and the future carrier wave. Whereas every other millennium registers as a new carrier wave. But the carrier wave must have a reference wave that precedes it by about 350 years and goes through the same energy frequency, so that there will be two sets of when there are carrier waves, when there are pivotal millennia, when there is a new carrier wave. And they curve just like the way in which a DNA double helix curves. That energy is time-bound, so that civilizations are not only in time like the universe is, but there are triple time form waves, the reference and the carrier waves, but there are also pilot wave persons, men and women, who are able to vision and understand and are the interim helpers to make sure that everything is remembered, is practiced, is prepared for. And those pilot wave men and women tend to cluster, especially just after a millennia and just before a carrier wave. Our carrier wave crossed the zero horizon threshold in 1991, so that when we're looking at the hermetic bodhisattvas of the 20th century, we're looking at men and women who, as pilot waves, were preparing so that the precariousness, which is always there, because there are not only regressions because of covetousness, because of sometimes even deeper nightmares, and something even more nefarious as evil, that one can tell by the clustering of the men and women pilot waves that it is building to the only thing that is really possible, and that is to prepare a transparency of the symbols in the structure of thought so that when that time form comes, that there will be enough people to be able to see through and see it. And it takes about a generation for that transparency to again reassume its capacities. One of the most poignant pilot wave couple in the early 19th century, 200 years almost ahead of time, were Percy Shelley and his wife Mary Shelley. And just as Mary Shelley was writing Frankenstein, the new Prometheus, Shelley was writing Prometheus Unbound. And he puts a Zarathustran kind of verse at the very end of Prometheus Unbound. To hope till hope creates from its own wreck the thing it contemplates. Never to falter nor lie. This, Titan, like thy gift, to reassume over the destruction, the new arrival. This is alone, life, joy, empire, and victory. The recognition of the pilot wave men and women has largely been lost over the past two generations, from about the late 1970s on till our time. But at the same time, in a non-visible way, the younger ones coming in are even more consciously transparent than ever. And so to nourish their possibilities, all of this kind of work is being done, has been done a long time now. A century after Shelley, the two Shelleys, about 1910, 1909, 1910, in that narrow wedge, there was a cluster of pilot waves that all of a sudden gelled and made a collective appearance. And one of the strongest pilot waves then, right at the end of his long life, was William James. James, who was the brother of the great novelist Henry James, had a couple of other brothers, had a sister, Alice James, were sort of force-fed by their father, Henry James Sr., to be geniuses. They were made when they were like three or four to keep learning new languages: German, French, Latin, Greek, along with English, some Spanish, some Italian. Alice could not handle the masculine landslide and ended up later needing to be taken care of. Henry James was successful because he, almost like a jiu-jitsu artist, kept sidestepping so that he didn't have to make final assessments. And so all his writings, his great novels and short stories are the complications of infinite complications that are able to show prismatic characters who you could read 20 times and come out with new aspects of them. One of his greatest works is Portrait of a Lady. And it is more and more enigmatic and riddling. And one of the great studies of Henry James was called the Ordeal of Change. It's an ordeal to keep going through it. So the deep ancient wisdom was, don't make it repetitious. Make it double chiral spiral, so that when you go through it again, you go through it deepened, not to have more complications, but to be able to weave a more complex pattern through a simpler vision. One thing that occurs increasingly in these kinds of situations of millennia, of into 500-year periods, the Phoenix cycles, carrier wave cycles, spirals, even more so, expressed in 1909 by the last series that William James gave. And its title, it was published in 1910, is A Pluralistic Universe. Very close to the differential conscious infinity of possibilities, cosmos, that we're working with a century later. But one of the aspects of William James is that in order to get to that capacity, he had to finish off the magnum opus of his life of that time, and that was to write the first textbook in psychology, which are two big, huge tomes published in 1890. Right at the start of the 1890s, which those of you who have been following my work, like in Science Fiction Vision, realized by the mid-1890s, everything had changed. H.G. Wells's The Time Machine, the discovery of the electron, the discovery of X-rays, and just immense amperage, and not just a push, but also a push that if you're not capable of recalibrating will scramble, will cause confusion. The ancient way to express that was an instrument that the wise head priestess would carry. And it was U-shaped with a couple of bars across the U. It was called a sistrum, and a couple of nodules in there, so that when she shook the sistrum, it caused a vibrating, cacophonic, confusing sound. That vibrating, cacophony, confusion sound was the feminine warning for those who would try to cause confusion as a falsity, and one of the masculine forms of that was the caduceus of Hermes, Hermes and Hermes Trismegistus especially. The caduceus is in this way a sistrum of silence. It punctuates the cacophony and the confusion with penetrating silence that is able to go into differential multiplicity and render what would have been confusing, you could recalibrate, not into an old articulateness, but into a new poetic of expressiveness, so that the old articulation, good as it was good as it was for a time form that once a time form is gone, it is gone from the universe, but is preserved intact in a very peculiar way. The modern way to talk about it is entanglement, so that it is accessible through higher dimensions as a heritage. And so to really live truthfully, not in the present of a civilization, but in the presence that carries civilization. If you look for the present now, moment, and you base your structure of symbolic thought on that, you're grabbing for power. You're grabbing for control. You're grabbing for things, for stuff. And that's a part of the confusion, not just the confusion in the energies that manifest as sound or sight or other senses, but especially posits where all of the cycle of integral comes together, and that's in the mind, in the symbolic structure of thought, into the powerful ideas that are the branding irons then of that power. And that's where the ideologies become not only pernicious, but evil in the sense of a neuter, a neutering of life, robbing men and women of their genders, of their life, not just as male or female, but the ambidextrousness of being male, female, the wonderful sharing beyond genders, beyond species. One can love animals. One can love plants. I learned to meditate at 19 in Sequoia National Park as the giant forest. The giant sequoia trees were my meditation teachers. So I have great affinity with trans species ways of sharing. Shows up in very peculiar ways. We were reading from the Gospel of Thomas before the break. Thomas was sent to India by Jesus, but before he could go to India, he had to do a special service for one of the nephews of Jesus, and that was young Mark, John Mark, who would become Saint Mark. At the crucifixion, resurrection, he was only 10 years old. And it was a little 10. He was never very big. Saint Mark was about 5'6", kind of burly. People called him the lion because he, a lot of hair and gruffness, but he had to be mentored from age 10 to age 13. Because at 13, Jewish men have their bar mitzvah. And so it was his cousin, who became St. James, who was the head of the way in Jerusalem, watched over him from 36 AD, when that occurred, for the 3 years to about 39, almost 40 AD. And then James could go off, and he went off to Spain. He went off to northwestern Spain because there were great shipping lanes that had passed on to some very powerful Jewish families. And the Jewish family of headed by Joseph of Arimathea, he had the shipping lanes that went on to the west country of England, where the tin mines, the lead mines were in the Devon, Somerset area. But in northwestern Spain, there were also tin mines. And that particular site, after he was there for about 3 more years, when he came back in 44 AD and passed through Ephesus, where Mary Magdalene and his brother John were. John, by this time, he was 12 and 36. So by the time of 44, he was about 18 years of age. And that's when these portraits of them were done by Mary Magdalene. He went on to Jerusalem, where he was seized by Herod Agrippa and was beheaded. And his body was sent back by shipping to northwestern Spain, and that's where the great pilgrimage shrine is. Santiago de Compostela, St. James of the Starfield. And it's the second biggest pilgrimage for Christianity in the world. The first, of course, is Jerusalem, Bethlehem, but Santiago de Compostela. And when it's an annual pilgrimage, and last year there were over 250,000 men and women who took that pilgrimage, that begins in the southern France, the Pyrenees, and goes all the way across northern Spain to Santiago de Compostela. And there, when you finish the pilgrimage, what you're given as the talisman of your having done this is a seashell. And that seashell, you can see in one of the great Renaissance paintings by Botticelli, The Birth of Venus, The Birth of Love, comes from a seashell boat riding on the waves. And this is how the gift of love comes, from the ability to be primordially of the ocean in such a way that you have this seashell boat, this bark of eternal life, because love opens all the thresholds without having to convince, through an invitation and a sharing. And when Thomas, as we're talking about, got to India, Thomas was an architect. Jesus' father was not just a carpenter, he was somebody who had the contacts with the forests in Lebanon, the shipping lanes, was able to do all kinds of things. In effect, he was an architect as well. And the king that Thomas was sent to build a temple for was Gondopharnes. And this is an ancient coin blown up in size. And you can see an infinity sign at the Ajna Chakra of Gondopharnes. He was extremely wealthy, had a very big kingdom. He gave tons and tons of money and jewels to Thomas to build him a beautiful temple, and then went off conquering. And when he came back, there was no building. Thomas had given away all of the money and jewels to the population of people, and Gondopharnes threw him in prison, till he began to realize that everyone loved him. He had raised, through Thomas's gifting of his wealth to the people so that everyone was very happy with Gandharvanus, and he realized that his temple was in the people. That's how it works. The Bodhisattva field has a six-pointed star like a snowflake, and each point of that six-pointed star is a paramita, a perfection. And the first paramita is gifting, dana. Not just giving, but gifting. And when gifting revs up through a double transformation, the gifting itself is like a fermentation, making the wine of conviviality, which when it deepens, distills, and becomes the alchemical liqueur of triple-powered double transcendence. And that is wisdom in Sanskrit, prajna. So dana becomes prajna when it deepens. The second paramita, sila, when it deepens, it is morality, but it becomes the great capacity of, in Sanskrit, it's virya, out of which we get virile or vigor. So that the order, the asha, the morality of real order, deepens so that one is able to have this strength. In tarot cards, it's the eighth major arcana, fortitude, strength. It's always has a feminine tone to it, just like wisdom, prajna, has a feminine tone. And the third, kshanti is patience, and it deepens into dhyana, which is meditation, contemplation. So that the first three paramitas you can give to children. And when they mature into adolescence, you can begin to alert them that there is more to come. Let it deepen so that when they reach a fuller maturity, they will be able to have the other three paramitas on a higher dimensional energy, and with the six together, everyone is related, but uniquely, prismatically themselves. It's like snowflakes. No two snowflakes are alike, but they're all snowflakes. They're all six-pointed stars. And so the kaleidoscopic infinity of possibilities is shareable, and it doesn't mash together into a blandness like a regressive evil ideology does. Here's an example. One of the shortest, most poignant autobiographies in the world was written by the great Russian poet Yevgeny Yevtushenko. It's called, in fact, A Precocious Autobiography, an English title. He was there with a number of his friends in Moscow, in Red Square, with hundreds of thousands of people, the day that Joseph Stalin died. The dictator who had held the population by the throat since the death of Lenin now died. And he recounts how people became numbed, stupid, confused, and they were beginning in their massive currents of milling, stamping on people, killing them, stamping them to death, and not caring and not knowing. And he said, we began to lock arms and make human chains, and urging others to join this, And only by putting that kind of a structure together did we stop 100,000 people from being stamped to death. As it was, there were many hundreds that were killed. You cannot numb the humanity of men and women for three, almost four generations, and not produce this kind of neutered evil. It produces a quality of abject loneliness so that one yearns for one's captor to keep you captured. The Patty Hearst syndrome. You yearn for they who put you in this jeopardy. In a dialogue series from 1980, poignant bad year, good bad year, Krishnamurti and David Bohm, The Ending of Time, and right at the end of it, at the last of their talking over the span of from April to September 1980, David Bohm says, yes, but the ordinary sense of loneliness is personal in the sense that each person feels it is his own. Krishnamurti, loneliness is not solitude. It is not aloneness. Bohm, I think all the fundamental things are universal, and therefore you are saying that when the mind goes deep, it comes into something universal. That's right. Whether or not you call it absolute, Krishnamurti, the problem is to make the mind go very, very deeply into itself. Twice over, thrice greatest. Bohm, yes. Now there is something that has occurred to me. When we started with a particular problem, our mind is very shallow. Then we go to something more general. The word general has the same root as to generate. The genus is the common generation. Krishnamurti, to generate, of course. Bohm, when we go to something more general, a depth is generated, but going on still further, the general is still limited because it is thought. Krishnamurti, quite right. But to go profoundly requires not only tremendous courage, but the sense of constantly pursuing the same stream. Not just continuity, but flowing. The phrase that William James used was stream of consciousness. And he learned to use that term in English because the French sense of the term, by a good friend of his, Henri Bergson, said that creative evolution is a stream of time that is, he used the French term, durée. It doesn't just continue, but it is that waterfall cascade stream on the zero horizon of the field of nature, which when it is brought into a transform can be at the same time the infinite field of differential consciousness. And when those two horizons tune together, they make available a third that was not even suspected. And that is the field of the real. Here's how this ends. It can't be just diligence, that still is too limited, right? Krishnamurti, yes, diligence is too limited. It goes with a religious mind in a sense that it is diligence in its action, its thoughts, and so on, but it is still limited. If the mind can go from the particular to the general, and from the general, and Bohm finishes for him, to the absolute, to the universal, but many people would say that is very abstract and has nothing to do with daily life. I know, yet it is the most practical thing and not an abstraction. Bohm, in fact, it is the particular that is the abstraction. Absolutely. The particular is the most dangerous. Wallace Stevens had in one of his poems that there's a falseness that has a kind of a time that granulates everything into indefiniteness, interchangeableness. Nothing is what it is, but only constituents of more gravel. They end. The human problems which arise in daily life cannot be solved there. You cannot solve the problems of daily life in daily life, because there's no space of articulation. More next week.